History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. A few years ago on this podcast, I did a multi-episode series on slavery throughout history, from the ancient world and basically the beginnings of human civilization, up until emancipation in the United States in 1865. One of the questions that historians dealt with slavery in the New World was slavery inevitable? Were there simply too many cash crops like sugar cane or cotton that required a lot of labor, and the manpower shortage was so great that slavery essentially had to happen? Or was slavery a conscious choice, and could it have been avoided had policy been different? Well, some argue that slavery was inevitable, and with recent projects like the 1619 Project, they'll say that slavery, however it happened in America, when it began in 1619, when traders came and sold slaves to the Virginia colony, this was a virus that infected the American body politic, and America hasn't been cured of this disease. Well, today's guest, Bob Zimmerman, who is continuing our series on Age of Discovery 2.0, argues that slavery was a conscious choice. If you look at the New England colonies, slavery was vigorously rejected. The Puritans wanted nothing to do with this institution and desired instead to form a society for your religious families, a society that became the foundation of the United States of America, which was dedicated to the Constitution and the Revolution and life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness and all that. But in the Virginia colonies in conquest, slavery was gladly embraced, resulting in a corrupt social order built on power, rule, and oppression. More specifically in Virginia, with the cash crop of tobacco, they established the headright system, which meant that colonists were given 50-acre tracts of land, and new settlers who paid their own passage to Virginia were granted one headright, and every other person they paid passage for were granted another headright. So the more indentured servants you brought over, the more land you got. And this system transferred over to slavery. So if you imported a large number of slaves, you were given an equally large plantation. This created the racial hierarchy we understand with the plantation system, and eventually slavery was codified into Virginia law, thus resulting in the social order of slavery that existed in the South and continued until the Civil War. All right, well, what does this all have to do with our Age of Discovery 2.0 series? The point that Bob is making here is that when a new society is set up, people have a conscious choice about what kind of society that is going to be, whether it's in the New World or whether it's on a far-flung planet. If a society is based on profit and exploitation, you aren't going to have education, you aren't going to have a healthy society, but you're going to have essentially a caste system. Whereas Bob argues that if it's based on small settlements, families, and the rule of law, then the outcome will be much better. There's a lot here to chew on, so I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Bob Zimmerman. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thank you for having me. I'm very grateful to be here. Thank you.
Well, you are quite the Renaissance man. You are a former filmmaker. You are a cave explorer. You're the author of four books on the first decades of space exploration. But you took a left turn and you wrote not only a book on the origins of slavery in colonial America, but I would say one of the clearest books I've read on the topic, including specialists in the field. So based on your previous interest, why did you want to write a book on this topic and how does it all connect together?
Well, Scott, it actually fits into everything because I'm interested in exploration, which is pushing the unknown. That's always been my number one interest. So when you do science, you're pushing the unknown. When you're Magellan crossing the circling the world or Columbus, you're pushing the unknown. You do cave exploration, you go where no one's ever gone before. I've done that. Every scientific question asks the same question. And so me writing about the history of space and doing cave exploration are all tied together. Now, why would I write a book then about the origins of slavery in America? Because the first American colonies were pushing the unknown. They were establishing new societies in a new world by explorers. And so, we're going to go to Mars and we're going to go to the stars someday and we're going to be establishing new societies. And in fact, building new societies is probably going to be the number one challenge of the human race for almost its entire future history. Because every new planet we go to, every time we settle a new colony, it's going to create a new society. And so what works and what doesn't was a question I kind of asked myself. And so I decided to go back and look. And the American colonies were a British colonies were an amazing experiment in this, because they didn't just establish one colony, they established 13. And of those 13, there were probably about 7 or 8 variations of a theme. And each one of them resulted in different consequences. And so it gives you an opportunity to actually, from a scientific point of view, understand what might work and what wouldn't. And so I focused in on Virginia particularly, and I did that being a lover of America and its freedoms and its concepts, its founding documents, and the idea of having a country of freedom and limited government. But I decided to focus in on Virginia where it failed. And so that, and then why it failed there would help inform future colonists on other planets what not to do to avoid similar evils like slavery from growing. And so that was that's the connecting piece. I should, you know, you say I'm a Renaissance man. I have to say, yes, I'm interested in almost any topic that strikes my interest, but they generally do fall into the category of exploring the unknown and pushing the limits of human society.
So I'm really interested on this particular facet of the Virginia colony, why it failed in the sense of why slavery was constructed. Because a couple of years ago, I did a multi-part series on slavery throughout human civilization, and listeners can go back in the archives and find that. I think it was in 2018. Going from the ancient world, where anthropologists would argue that slavery basically appears as soon as human civilization appears, when there's any sort of manpower shortage and when there's any possibility to subjugate another human, you will simply going to see slavery as it is an organic outgrowth of life. Now, once we get further on, we start to see slavery die out in England past the Middle Ages. By the time it's setting up colonies in England itself, there aren't slaves. There's not plantations. In the Middle Ages, you have serfs, but they're not nearly the same as Roman slaves. You have serfdom in Rome. You have slaves in the Ottoman Empire, but it's more of a type of indentured servanthood than a chattel slavery. And when I was doing the series, I mean, because I was doing such a broad sweep, I couldn't really come into a particular moment in history and fill in the gaps. But the way my brain filled it in was sort of, well, in the New World, it wouldn't have been possible to have not had slavery because there was simply a manpower shortage. You have sugarcane plantations, you have cotton plantations. There's so much manpower that's needed to be able to harvest these cash crops that settlers couldn't organically come in and set up family farms. You'd have to bring in a lot of other people to do all this work. But what you argue in your book is that's not the case. So I suppose, like, let's begin with the Virginia colony.
Oh, wait, you know what, Scott?
Yeah.
Scott, let me back up. Let me talk about slavery first, because it's a misconception. It is actually a misconception that slavery just automatically comes out of a shortage of labor. The original reason there is a really brilliant book, which I cannot dig out of my name, about slavery in the modern world, in which the author talks at great length. It's a classic book about slavery in civilization. And it existed mostly as a proper moral solution to the problem of captured soldiers. You fight a war and you captured your soldiers, the enemy soldiers. What do you do with them? The old solution is you kill them all. What else can you do? You can't keep them in a prison camp the rest of their lives. And the moral solution in ancient civilizations was actually, well, we'll make them slaves. At least they'll be useful. They won't have, their lives won't end. And this is actually the best moral choice we can get at the time and in the situation. And that, to a great extent, is where slavery came from in the ancient world. It was not a solution just simply for manpower, because there are places where they were not slaves. It was almost always used as a tool to a moral choice to try to not be too genocidal if you want a war. And so now you get into after the Dark Ages. England never had slavery because England as a culture was very Roman-based, British-based, Judeo-Christian-based, and those philosophical things that were very fundamental to its culture did not allow for chattel slavery. It just wasn't proper. And they didn't need to enslave their enemies. They just didn't have that need. So they didn't have it. All they had was indentured servitude, which was used almost exclusively as a training ground for the youth. that when someone was in a situation where they had no money or no opportunity, you would indenture your child to some craftsman or as an apprentice, he would learn a trade. And there were very strict rules. It was not oppressive. It was designed in the long run to get that person a career and a livelihood. And so that's how it functioned in England. When you get to Virginia, things change. And now your question was specifically, how did it change in Virginia? Is that correct? Is that your question?
Right. Because I think, sadly, because of the 1619 Project, everyone has a mental shortcut where they think, oh, that's when the first slave ship came. So
yes.
Slavery, it comes to Virginia, and then it metastasizes until it takes over the body politic of the colonies. And that is with us today, which is the thesis of the 1619 Project. And honestly, is about as deep mentally as it goes. But so describe, yeah, the origins of it in Virginia and how does it come out?
Okay. Well, people have a tendency to telescope time into nothing. 1619 happened, 25 slaves arrived, and the next day it's 1776 and we're writing the Constitution and we want slavery as part of our nation. But you know, from 1620, 1619, when those first slaves arrived, to 1680, when slavery was really pretty much finally becoming established in Virginia, you've got 60 years past, six decades. That's two plus generations. And in that period of time, almost more than half a century, slavery did not become embedded in the Virginia colony. You had some slaves there, but they only arrived serendipitously because Dutch traders might need to stop in Virginia. And when they did, they'd sell some slaves. But as a general rule, very few slaves were in Virginia for the first 60 years, very few indeed. And in fact, by 1650, you have a thriving free black community in Virginia where many of the slaves that had arrived were freed. We became citizens. You had intermarriage between whites and blacks, no opposition of that at all. And so slavery doesn't become embedded for a long time. It's very important to understand that, just as we understand that 1940 is a very different place than 2021 now. 1619 is a very different place from 1680, 1690. And so when those slaves first arrived, they were arriving in a centrally British colony that was trying to recreate the culture of Britain, which did not accept slavery at all. And so the process over the next 60 years, because of poor decisions made by leaders in Virginia and an unwillingness to change those decisions, is what allowed slavery to finally embed itself in Virginia itself.
And that was an interesting point in your book that I think shows the contingency of how this happened, that it didn't need to happen in the 1650s or thereabouts, where not only do you have a free black population, you don't have miscegenation laws that you would see in the Jim Crow South. So in some ways, it was way easier for a white person to marry a black person in 1650 than it was in 1950, which, I mean, really tweaks the narrative.
Correct.
So I'm curious, I mean, a lot of what you describe in your book is the headright system and the economic incentives to create this colony then lead to slavery. So what is the system? Why was it established and what are the results of it?
Yes, the headright system was probably the fundamental and first era the leaders of the Virginia colony established. When Virginia colony was established, it was done as a joint stock company to make money. To establish a colony in Virginia to either mine gold, they thought they'd find it like the Spanish were, or to somehow find some other way to make money. And they were not being very successful. So, you know, they had ups and downs, mostly downs in the first decade and a half. And in 1619, the same year that those first slaves arrived, the head of the joint stock company in England restructured the legal system of that colony. He decided that the way we're going to encourage immigrants, because they weren't getting immigrants to come to Virginia, the way we're going to encourage them is to reward someone for paying for the transportation of a new immigrant. So, for example, if an immigrant wishes to come to Virginia and paid for the transportation, they would get 50 acres. However, if someone else paid for that transportation, the payer, not the immigrant, would get the 50 acres. Now, this was a decision made by Edwin Sandys, the head of the company in Virginia, and he made it because he probably thought that the poor people they would like to get to come to Virginia, they need a lot of immigrants, and they prefer to get a lot of poor people to reestablish new lives, they couldn't afford the transportation. So let's have someone pay it for them. But they gave the reward to the person who paid, which meant that you centralized power among the wealthy in Virginia, because they would, by bringing over a lot of immigrants, they could accumulate a lot of land. And then they added to that, and this was something that the Sandys, the head of Virginia Company, had nothing to do with. The large owners in Virginia in 1619, they established a legal system whereby to pay back the transportation costs, the immigrant was going to have to give the payer, the person who paid for his transportation, up to 4 years of free labor. It was indentured servitude, but it was only for the purpose of paying back for that transportation. So what did the owners get, the plantation owners, these early plantation owners? They got free labor for 4 years, and they got 50 acres. What did the immigrant get? He pretty much got nothing. He basically came over to Virginia, and he had nothing. He had basically, when he finished those 4 years of indentured servant, they gave him freedom dues, a very small amount, and a suit of clothes, and he's out on his own. And since all the land is taken up by these big owners, there's not much good land to get and set up his own farm. So that headright system right away created a corrupt system. It corrupted the institution of indentured servitude. It was now merely a labor system. And it corrupted how land was acquired so that it was not acquired by many different people, but by large landowners with a lot of money.
Right. In theory, you could have someone wealthy who's importing dozens of British poor people, and this is colonizing the New World. But in practice, something very different happens. And this is in stark contrast to what happens later in American history, like the Homestead Act, where if you migrate out west and are willing to cultivate land, then it's eventually yours. There's no sense of ownership here as well.
I mean, you know, let's contrast it with the Pilgrims and the Puritans who were settling New England the exact same time. They basically set up a system that anyone that immigrated would get their own farm. And they would own the farm themselves, and their goal was to be self-sufficient farmers. They weren't there to make a lot of money and ship profits back to England. They were there to become a self-sufficient farmer on their own farm. So the fundamental difference is immediate. You're encouraging families to come to the New England, owning their own property and raising their children. While in Virginia, you're encouraging a basically like a boomtown gold town, you know, gold, company town where everyone comes. It's basically there to be a male laborer. You don't have many women. You don't have families coming over. They don't own anything. And they're basically working for the boss. And so you get a very, not very healthy society. And so that contrast is very clear right there. The Homestead Act came out of the dominance of American culture by the Pilgrim Puritan descendants that controlled, that culturally controlled America. That Homestead Act, by the way, was passed during the Civil War when the Southerners had seceded from Congress. And so the people that were left were all from the North following Puritan Pilgrim concepts. And so they passed the Homestead Act to allow people to earn a piece of property for themselves. And so it actually ties directly back into those early colonies and the cultures between the North and the South.
And could you flesh out some of the differences in culture between the Virginia colony and the New England colony? So we mentioned that the economic difference that in the South, you have the headright system, in the North, you have families who are setting up smaller farms. But can you also talk about the differences in education and religious establishments?
Okay. So in the South, in Virginia particularly, the colony was set up as this joint stock company initially to make money. Now, eventually that went away, but the goal was still to make money. There was no, and it was because the power was centralized to the leadership, to this very small cadre of royalists, you know, cavaliers, wealthy plantation owners. Their interest was making money and money for themselves. And so that was the focus of everything. In New England, the reason they came over was religious. The Puritans and the Pilgrims were very focused on finding a place to raise their children the way they believed they should be raised. And so they came to Virginia to do that. I'm sorry, they came to New England to do that. And so their focus is entirely on raising their kids under their biblical ideals of the Old Testament beliefs of what they should do. And so in doing so, they came, they established small communities, each person owning their own farm, self-sufficient, and they were required to go to church every weekend, and they had to educate their children to be able to read the Bible. So remarkably enough, while in Virginia, there was no education system because the focus was just making money. There were very fewer families. People didn't immigrate as families. And so you weren't focused on raising your kids. In New England, their focus was raising the kids. So in order to read your Bible and be religious, you had to be literate. And so amazingly enough, New England was almost 100%, had almost 100% literacy almost a century before England did. By the late 1600s, almost everyone in New England could read, children and adults. And while once again in Virginia, the focus is not to bring families and set up farms. It was to make money and bring laborers. You had a skewed sex ratio. Very few women came over, not many families. And there was one other additional factor that was outside of everyone's control, that in Virginia, the climate was not healthy for new immigrants. It was expected that 1 in 9 would die the first year they were there from illness, from disease, from malaria, from the diseases that, you know, come from entering a new place where there's biology your body's not used to. So what that did is it forced a lot of death on the colony. So even if you were a child born in Virginia to a mother and father, there was a better than 50% chance that by the time you were 12, you were living in a broken home. You'd lost one of your parents, maybe both, because they died of disease. And so that also, because they didn't encourage families to begin with, even when they had families, there was a very good chance that life was fleeting. People would die. I don't know if that answers all those components. There are more, of course, but that's some of them.
Well, what you describe in Virginia in the 17th century, it's an exploitative society. It's based on wealth. They're not trained to really educate anyone. They're taking people in. And as you know, as people arrive on slave ships, sometimes owners will take them and they'll release them after their term is up. Maybe they won't. They'll think, hey, these aren't British subjects, so I don't have to inform them of their rights. Maybe they're not even aware of them, so I might just keep them on a little longer.
Let me insert. This is what you just said. It was, to a certain extent, exactly what happened. The Virginia plantation owners, they didn't just keep people happenstance, but over those decades that I described, they very carefully, being in control of all legislatures and all legislative action, they very carefully increased the indentitude period over a period of time, adding a year here, a year there, so that by the 1670s, 5-6 decades later, it wasn't 4 years anymore. It was routinely 8 years that you'd have to work. The immigrant didn't get anything extra for those 4 extra years, but the plantation owner got 4 extra years of indentured servitude. So they did exactly what you did, but they did not make it indefinite. Where they made it indefinite and what they began to realize is, you know, we could bring some blacks into the colony as slaves, claim 50 acres of land under the headright system, and then we didn't have an indentured servant for 4 or 8 years, we'd have one for life. And so that's what they did. Some, not many, but some plantation owners started to bring blacks in and realize, oh, we can make even a better deal with black slaves. And after a while, they suddenly realized, well, you know, a British law tends to say that if you convert to Christianity, you cannot be a slave. So British law generally would free someone who was a slave if they converted to slavery and to Christianity and became baptized. Well, by the 1660s, the plantation owners in control of the Virginia legislature decided that wasn't good. We want to hold on to our slaves. And so they changed the law so that whether you converted to Christianity or not, you would remain a slave. So this is all of a piece trying to increase their power and wealth by manipulating the law to their benefit. And they constantly would talk about how they wanted to fix this unhealthy culture there, because the colony was not as successful as it could be, and they knew it. But they always twiddled around the edges because the heart of the problems, the headright system and the wrong kind of immigrants coming to the colony and the lack of education and the lack of any strong religious framework or moral framework in the colony, all those things required fundamental changes that they didn't want to make the sacrifices to do. So they worked, they nibbled at the edges and never touched them.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. We're Right. And there's some interesting theological contortions that happen at this time, where in the 17th century, when slaves from Africa are first brought, some might argue from the Old Testament that, well, the Israelites had slaves and they weren't Jews or monotheists, so it was lawful to do so. But later, when slaves convert to Christianity, then you get the curse of Ham and this type of things coming up. So when is slavery formalized? When is it legally formalized in the way that's understood in the beginning of the United States?
I would say this really started to happen in the 1660s in Virginia in the legislature. As I mentioned, that was the period of time that the minority of plantation owners that were actually bringing slaves in to claim head rights and get permanent slaves for themselves gained full control of the legislature. There was something called the Long Assembly that actually existed in power for about 13 years with no elections. It was a change from before. They'd been having elections once a year. They stopped. They suddenly had a Long Assembly, no elections for a period of 13 years. And during that time, they began to pass the laws that made slavery legal. I mentioned one where they said you could no longer become free by becoming baptized. They changed another law. In the past, a black woman who married a white man, a plantation owner, her children would have the legal status of the father. So therefore, a black slave woman who married a landowner, her children would be free and they would be descendants and inheritors of the plantation owner's property. Well, they changed that law. They said, nope, the children of a slave are always slaves. And that also changed the situation. And so by the end of the 16th, about 1676, when you had Bacon's Rebellion, slavery was pretty much legal in Virginia. You could bring slaves over, you could own them, forever, and their descendants would be slaves as well. And it was tied to race at that point in Virginia, very clearly tied to race. And so now, once again, in 1676, there's still a small population of slaves. Most landowners don't own slaves. But now the situation is very much encouraging slavery. And you have on top of that, the King of England, King Charles, he could make money from it himself. So he encouraged it also as well. And so from that point on, slavery began to grow in leaps and bounds. So that within 60 years from that moment on, half the colony was made of slaves. Half. By 1750, half the colony was slaves. And that took almost 150 years for that process to complete itself.
I think you noted in the book that up till Bacon's Rebellion, there was pushback against this system, the headright system, where at least people could see what it was creating, this type of neo-feudalism. Can you describe that, the sort of pushback and why it failed?
Yeah, most of the pushback that occurred came from two different groups. One religious and the other political. This, you got to understand, and I tie my book closely with the political events that were going on in England at the time, because this is during the period of Cromwell and the Parliamentary Revolution and the Glorious Revolution, whereby they beheaded a king and were trying to establish the parliamentary system for the very first time. So in Virginia, you had one of the groups was what I called parliamentarians, a lot of the people with connections in England with the parliamentarians that were establishing the first parliaments in England. And so they in Virginia wished to do the same thing. And that the philosophy of the parliamentarians in general was the idea of the right to vote, control of government by the populace, not by a royalty. The people are sovereign, not the king. So this was one of the pushbacks because they wanted to decentralize power away from these powerful lords and rulers, the plantation owners. That was one. And the other one was religious. The revolution that occurred in England was very closely tied to the Puritan movement, the religious revolution that was going on in England at the time. Basically, the Protestant Revolution had taken England by storm in the 1600s. You had dozens and dozens of religious sects of all kinds arguing freely and relatively peacefully about which is the right religion to follow. And by the end of that century, England had finally decided we can't forbid any of them and we can't tell any of them that you have to follow the Church of England. We have to let them be free to argue their point. And so in Virginia, you have the religious Puritans who many were coming down from New England who wished to settle in Virginia and establish some of their beliefs there as well. This includes also Quakers who did not believe in the idea of slavery. And so they were both giving pushback, these two groups. The problem is that they were a small minority. And on top of that, the leaders in, there was a third group I should talk about, which is who they were fighting, the Royalists. These are the people who had tied themselves to the king in England, who believed in royalty, who believed in a top-down culture whereby there was a royal divine right to rule by some people. And these royalists, many of whom fled England during the Revolution, now dominated the political structure of England, of Virginia, and therefore made it very difficult for the parliamentarians that were there and the Puritans that were there and the Quakers from there to resist their control. And so the result is that in the end, these people lost. They had to flee. Most of them fled Virginia. Some were there and did nothing to fight it. And this is what where my title of my book comes from, Conscious Choice. Some didn't fight it. Some did and failed. And some fled. And those were the options many of them made.
So from this standpoint, what happens? It sounds like that there's two different branches of evolution in Virginia. You sort of have the Denisovians or the Neanderthals. And then up north, you have the Homo sapiens, these different approaches to how society are built. If you have small family farms versus large plantations that are built on the backs of indentured servitude or slave labor. And something like the 1619 Project would make you think, well, it's all Virginia, and this is a virus that just spreads throughout the body politic, where what you're describing is there's two different branches of evolution happening. Is it finally one dominating the other in the Civil War, or how does,
yes,
in your telling, how does the history resolve itself?
Well, it's very clear. You have the United States, once formed in 1776, and during the Revolution, during the mid-1700s, is actually a house divided upon itself. You've got the southern colonies all influenced by Virginia, all having slavery, all having a very similar top-down culture where the powerful plantation owners run the colony. And this involves North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi. All those colonies were very similar in their structure to Virginia. And then in the north, you have every colony that was established was very much influenced by the religious sects that established them, in the Pilgrims, the Puritans, the Quakers, Roger Williams in Rhode Island, and they therefore did not want slavery. And in fact, they did not have slavery. By the time the Revolution occurs, most of the blacks in the northern colonies are free. And slavery is, especially in Massachusetts and in the real New England colonies, slavery is actually outlawed. It cannot be. And if you are a slave, you have rights. And you could not be punished in the same way. You were not considered property. And so this house divided upon itself established a country where, you know, they tried to put aside the problem of slavery so they could become an independent nation and establish their concepts of limited government and private property and individual liberty. And it is an interesting, I was just reading about this today and wrote about this today. Thomas Jefferson wanted a southern plantation owner. He wanted to include in the Declaration of Independence condemnation of slavery. And the southern states made him take that. They insisted that get removed from the Declaration of Independence or they wouldn't sign it. So for a political decision, they had to take it out. So the two parts of the country were in a war, political war, right from the beginning. And that political war kept escalating over the next 70, 80 years until the Civil War. What happened in the Civil War is that finally the northern New England Puritan-based, religious-based, family-based culture dominated. As you say, there was a war and the southern Virginia-based, slave-based, top-down-based culture fought a war with the family-based, bottom-up, more British-based culture of the Puritans and lost. And the result was that we had a country that was 100%, that was trying to establish 100% freedom everywhere. Slavery was not allowed. And you didn't get freedom for the blacks because the slave owners were not going to accept this lying down. And so for the next 100 years after the Civil War, they fought to keep their power intact. But they didn't have the same kind of power anymore. And steadily and slowly, the dominant culture of the North eroded that plantation culture in the South till by the civil rights movement in the 100 years later, discrimination against blacks, racial discrimination, was pretty much over. But for the last 50 years, my whole life, discrimination was not allowed in the United States. You didn't do it. If you did do it, you were going to find your life very miserable. And so blacks had the opportunity to become as successful as whites for most of my life and have been successful doing so because our culture has become what became dominated by that family-oriented religious culture of the Puritans that was established in the New England colonies in the 1600s.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Right, and for other episodes, if listeners want to check out in the archives of, I mean, if we want to relitigate 1776 again, which I don't, but the point is that the success is that the promises there were a promissory note that later on people like Frederick Douglass or Martin Luther King Jr. said this is a promissory note of equality before the law for all people, not that there is some sort of embedded structural racism like the 1619 Project says. It's going to perpetuate white supremacy, but it's this sneaky little cabal of supremacists, even though it's not explicated in the law. But let's not, you know, relitigate all that again. So part of what your book is doing is saying that this is a conscious choice that happened in the past. And as new societies are being rebuilt in the future, these are questions we're going to have to come to again. And this whole series that I'm doing, The Age of Discovery 2.0, it looks at the past to understand the future. And this question about human liberty and flourishing in colonies, this is something that sci-fi has approached. It could be the neo-feudalism view, like Blade Runner, where there's a bunch of slave replicants that are watching attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion and sea beams glittering in the dark at the Tannhauser Gates, or the version of like human libertarianism paradise, like Robert Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. But some could say, well, we're going to have technological abundance in the future. We'll all have Elon Musk's Tesla bots. So this issue is just solved, whatever. I mean, it's going to be fine. We don't have to worry about it. So what would you say to that as we set up new societies?
I think one of the major mistakes most science fiction writers and most people who, futurists, who want to talk about colonies in space is they always think in terms of going where no one has gone before, exploring the unknown, we're establishing new places on new worlds. And that, to a great extent, is the point of view of the Virginia colony. And I think it's much more important to take the perspective of the New England colonies, who did not come to establish, to go where no man has gone before or no person has gone before. They came to Virginia to find a place to raise their children. Their focus was on their children, on the next generation. What do we do to make this place a good place for our children? Now, you don't have to necessarily follow the tenets of the Puritans to do that. But you need to be focused on that next generation. That means you think in terms of how you educate them. You think in terms of a family structure so that they live, they grow up in a safe environment, that they are secure. You think about those fundamental factors. You think about how to teach them a moral concepts that they can use in their future lives to make good choices. You make that decision. You focus on that more than anything else. And That is the fundamental difference between the northern and southern colonies in British colonies in that 1600s. The northern colonies, they made conscious choices to focus on raising the later generations properly so that they would build good society into the future. And they succeeded. While in the southern colonies, they did not think about that. Children were a secondary issue to them. They weren't interested in families. They were just interested in making money. And they were interested in making money by any means necessary, even if it meant enslaving people. And the result of that was they created a society that was a failed society, an unjust society, and it did not work. And it became an unhealthy place to live for both whites and blacks for many centuries. And it didn't start to, the South, as I describe it, didn't really start to dissolve away until my lifetime in the 60s and 70s. I remember once, as in my 20s, I was going to take a month-long bicycle trip from New York City to Louisiana. I was going to be in the South during the whole time. And I can't tell you the number of friends of mine who said, you're Jewish, white, you're going to get lynched when you go through the South, because that's the impression they had of the South. And I visited the South at a time the South was changing. It was no longer that Southern top-down culture anymore. It was finally beginning to free up and become a good place, which it is today. You don't think of the South as different from the North anymore. We don't think in those terms anymore. And so it took 300-plus years to solve the problem of the errors of the Virginia colony. And I think for future colonists building colonies on Mars, they damn well better think about these issues immediately. If they don't, they're going to condemn generations of their children and children's children and children's children to evils that they can't even imagine. And I hope that answers your question.
So you would say that the ingredients of a good culture are something like Star Trek: The Next Generation, where you might have families on board, there's educational infrastructure, there's things that for a full civilization, not like The Expanse, where you just have dingy environments around asteroids trying to pull water out and things like that.
Well, I wouldn't use Star Trek on except maybe the first series. I wouldn't use Star Trek as an example, because Star Trek is a fascist society where the military rules everything and everyone's in uniforms and everyone works for the military and there's no money and there's no profit. And the government, such as Deep Space Nine, can step in at any time and take your property away from you. And that happens many times in these shows. No, I wouldn't use Star Trek as an example. But I do think it is very important that we, as I say in my conclusion, I talk about it, many of the problems we have right now in legally for establishing colonies in space in the near future. We have legal issues that have to be addressed. But I say that when you establish your colonies, you should be thinking in terms of raising kids, educating them, having a family, small holdings privately owned by individuals who have as much freedom as possible to function, but at the same time, not make money the be-end and the end-all. You know, I wrote a policy paper called Capitalism in Space, which has had, I think, great influence on both the Trump and Biden administration and how they're running space right now. And so I believe very strongly in private property and capitalism and freedom. But I think it's a very big mistake if you make that your sole choice. You have to put a moral component in what you do. And that means sometimes, making the most money is not necessarily the choice. Working for this corrupt company is not maybe the right choice. I'll quit. Maybe this company is doing something I don't like. I'm going to go find a different job. It all comes down to the same thing. You've got to make some moral choices and keep them in your mind. And a lot of those moral choices have always got to be thinking about the next generation's consequences.
All right. Before I wrap up, I made a lot of analogies here to different sci-fi properties, but are there any that come to your mind as positive examples? Just, if listeners can think of things that stick out to their mind. Most of them are dystopian, so it's kind of hard.
Yeah, my problem to a certain extent is that though I was an avid reader of science fiction through the 1970s, and have read everything that was written in science fiction prior to 1980 that was published, I pretty much lost interest in science fiction in the 80s and 90s, and I've not read much since then. So anything I can give you, I can't really think of anything that comes to mind. Robert Heinlein is one of the reasons he's unique is he's one of the few writers in science fiction who recognizes a lot of these issues. He doesn't come at it the exact same way I would, but he recognizes these issues without any question. The importance of individual liberty, the importance of moral choice, of conscious choice by each individual. He recognizes those things, and those are very important things for each of us to keep in mind at all times. You have to make a moral choice. And by thinking, I don't have to make a choice here, I can just go the easy route, well, you've made a moral choice. And that's a mistake right there and there. So you have to be aware that anything you do is a choice. And so isn't it better to think about it a little bit and make the choice that's correct rather than the choice that is incorrect?
All right. Well, there's a lot to unpack here, as you described. And for listeners who want to dive in more, your book is Conscious Choice. And where can people find you online to find more about not only your book, but other writings that you've produced?
Well, I have a website called Behind the Black, Behind the Black. And the way I tell people to remember that title, that website, behindtheblack.com, and this is where the name comes from. Think of the black sky behind the astronauts when they are on the moon. Right? The sky is black. In fact, William Shatner, when he flew this, when he did that first flight in suborbital flight in space, he came out and that was the thing he talked about, that black sky that forbidden universe. So what I try to do is ask what's behind the black. And on my website, you can see the other space histories I've written. You can get them. They're available on all the vendors. But if you buy them on my website, I get a little more money and a little sooner, which is, of course, always appreciated. But you can also, I write about space every day. I write about cultural issues every single day on my website. I must post between 10 and 20 different columns a day. I write a lot. It's the only way I keep my brain sane is to write. So that's what I do continuously.
There we go. So listeners, check it out, because a little bit of affiliate income never hurts anyone. All right, Bob, I really appreciate you joining us, and thanks for sharing all this with us.
Scott, thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
All right, that is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.